Welcome to This Is Money podcast. I'm Georgie Frost, and joining me today is editor Simon Lambert. And coming up, despite turmoil in the banking sector, rates go up again here and the other side of the pond. Is that it, though? Or with an unexpected jump in inflation, are there more rises to come from the Bank of England? And what does the banking turmoil mean for you and your money? Plus, should you sell your investments now, asks our Simon, and the retro gear making a minted auction? Thanks to millennials and Gen Z. Don't forget you're up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.
But first, against the backdrop of troubles in the global banking system and an unexpected jump in inflation over here, the Bank of England upped the base rate for the 11th time on the bounce. The rate now stands at 4.25%. It was just 0.1% 14 months ago. While many analysts expect this to be the peak base rate, the Bank of England boss is warning more could be on the way if businesses hike their prices. So why is the Bank of England raising rates? Why is the Fed raising rates? What does it mean for the economy and for our money? Simon, it does seem wherever the Fed leads, the Bank of England follows. But was this expected rise, 25 basis points?
Yes, it was the entirely expected scenario until the events of the past week and a bit unfolded. You can actually go back 2 weeks to when the Silicon Valley Bank collapse, and we can call it a collapse, it was effectively a collapse, happened or emerged. But it was really the stuff with Credit Suisse having to be forced into an emergency takeover by UBS that really roiled the markets and led to, on Monday, people think, well, that's it. The Fed and the Bank of England, they're going to hold. They're not going to raise rates. Not against the worst banking crisis since 2008, they're not. I think that underestimated the Fed and the Bank of England and their determination to try and be seen to be really cracking down on inflation. And I think that what the Fed and the Bank of England have done is they've looked at the scenario and they have gone, this is relatively contained. This is something that is affecting a small number of banks in America due to their circumstances that don't reflect the circumstances that affect all the mega banks around the world that really matter, and also Credit Suisse. And if we're going to be entirely honest, Credit Suisse has been a bit of a basket case for a very long time. Just Google Credit Suisse scandal and then have a read of all the things that's happened with Credit Suisse recently.
It's a catalogue
of disaster. And you will realise that why central bankers and their monetary policy committees have gone, well, look, we don't really think that this Credit Suisse thing is a major issue. Obviously, there is the danger of contagion into the rest of the financial system. And the worry is that banks will now switch into safety mode and be a lot more cautious with their lending. And that will exacerbate what central banks are trying to do. Or alternatively, it will just help central banks. And it will mean that central banks only need to do this one more raise that they've just done. And perhaps now they'll stop.
If the Bank of England and the Fed, particularly the Bank of England, given the unexpected rise in inflation, had decided not to continue, would it have sent out a message that they're a little bit more concerned about this situation and therefore we should be concerned?
Maybe. Yes, I suppose so. And banking is a confidence trick, ultimately,
exactly.
Because if everybody decides to take all their money out at once, all banks have a problem. Central banking is also a confidence trick. And it's a trick where you have to either boost confidence or lower confidence. And you need to be careful not to do too much of one or too much of the other and the unintended consequences that come with it. I think that if you look at the Monetary Policy Committee, how they make decisions, how they vote, all of the evidence that we get from the minutes, from the briefings, from the speeches, from the interviews that they do, we're not talking about a bunch of people here who are suddenly dramatically swayed in their decision that is announced on the Thursday. And bear in mind, they've made their decision before the Thursday by some news that came out on the Tuesday or the Wednesday. they're looking at this over a longer time period. And if something really, really, really dramatic happened, then they might change their mind. But inflation tickling up when clearly the path is downward over the rest of the year isn't going to make a huge difference and cause them to go, right, we better add that 0.25% to rates. And for the reasons that we discussed a minute ago, I think they'd already decided that they weren't going to pause anyway, and that they were going to add it to it. But you are right. A pause from either the Bank of England or the Fed would have said, we're more worried than we're letting on about this. And then people might go, ooh, maybe there is a problem. I mean, maybe there is a bigger problem than people are letting on, but they can't let on that there might be a big problem because then that would make the problem worse.
Exactly. I want to talk about the banking situation in more detail in a short while, but stick with interest rates and inflation, an unexpected jump, Simon, core inflation as well going up. Why has that happened? All about salads?
Yes, and actually you have to look at the fact that this inflation, this month of inflation that we're looking at here, looking at the February figures, covers the month when the latest thing that we would have thought a few years ago would lead to mass panic and confusion unfolded in the UK, and everyone just shrugged their shoulders and went, it's no fruit and veg now. Oh, well, it's a few stories written about it. Everybody pointed the finger at where they thought the blame lay.
If it had been chocolate, it would have been slightly different, maybe.
Maybe, but, you know, we always thought there'd be uproar if they shut the pubs, and everyone just went, pubs are shut now.
Drink at home.
It's, you know, yes, it's amazing. Absolutely amazing.
We're such a resilient nation, aren't we?
It's unbelievable how malleable the population actually is when you look at it. We've talked about this before. It makes you look at the what was dubbed Project Fear to do with Brexit. And there was a big deal made about Project Fear because it was like, you are scaremongering. You are really worrying people with this talk of no food on the shelves and all this kind of stuff and traffic jams all the way from Dover stretching up towards London. And lo and behold, things unfold a little bit like that. And everyone goes, no food. Anyway, so what you're looking at is food inflation across that month. So obviously, when there is a shortage of something, the price of the thing goes up. If there's none of it, obviously you can't sell it at a higher price, but the shops that still have some can whack the prices up. So that helped food inflation go up as well. If you look at what's happening with energy prices and what's forecast to happen with energy prices, if you look at what's happened with fuel prices as well, food inflation is an interesting one. And we talked about this a couple of podcasts back about how it's stuck around for a lot longer than people thought it was going to stick around. But that's going to ease at some point. And even if food prices don't fall, just food price inflation easing is going to bring down inflation. Building materials, there's a real slowdown in construction that's going to affect that. All kinds of things are going to drag inflation down. And the forecast from the Office of Budget Responsibility last week in the budget was that inflation's going to be heading down towards around about 3% by the end of the year, 2% early next year. It's not forecast actually to fall below zero for quite as long as was expected back in November when we had the super, super pessimistic autumn statement and OBR report. But it is forecast to actually fall quicker, but then not go quite as low and then start to pick up in 2026, but only back to that 2% target. So that's the picture with inflation. So the Bank of England and the central banks are looking at this and they're going, okay, effectively job done, but we don't want to call time too early on these rate rises. We want to make absolutely sure that we've nailed it. Now, whether that is the right decision is another matter.
Is that the right decision, Simon?
Potentially it is, and it's better to really be seen to be tackling inflation. The problem is, of course, is that what we've spoken about is that the inflation that we're seeing at the moment, above 10% inflation, that's really got very little to do with anything the Bank of England can affect with interest rates. Global energy prices, Bank of England can do what it likes with interest rates, it's not going to affect global energy prices. But that inflation figure is backward looking. The inflation that the Bank of England is worried about is the inflation in the future. it's worried about what the inflation figure is going to be in a year's time. And that's why it wants to be seen to be very firm. That's why Andrew Bailey was on the radio this morning telling companies to stop putting up prices or we'll have to keep raising interest rates. That's why the Bank of England doesn't want people asking for big pay rises and companies giving in and giving big pay rises. It's why the government is trying to avoid giving bumper pay rises across the public sector and all these other things. You need to dampen expectations and dampen the things that will cause inflation to be higher in the future, because 1 year of double-digit inflation is really quite rubbish. 2 years of double-digit inflation is a serious problem. 3 years of double-digit inflation, and then you really start to worry.
So in response to the Bank of England raising interest rates, as you say, whether that's going to work, who knows? But 4.25, Simon, have we hit peak interest rate, or is there more to go? Are we ever going to get back to those super low rates we've had for over a decade?
There was a widespread belief until relatively recently that the Bank of England would hit a peak of 5%. That has then been downgraded to 4 to 4.5%. We're at 4.25, so we're in the middle of that. The big question is, do we have one more? Do we go to 4.5%? Is that going to be the peak? We'll see how the next month or so unfolds, I guess, really. And I think that this could very much be the peak, or they might just chuck another one in there for good measure. Also, you've got to watch what the Fed does in the US, because that leads the Bank of England to a certain degree. It doesn't have to directly mirror what the Fed is doing, but it doesn't want to diverge too much from it. You start to have currency issues, which can then lead to more inflation because importing stuff is costing us more money. Capital Economics, Paul Dales, chief UK economist at Capital Economics, this is his words. Our current forecast is that the Bank of England will raise interest rates from 4.25% now to a peak of 4.5% in the coming months and keep rates there all year. The events of the past few weeks increase the chances of interest rates peaking below 4.5% and perhaps being cut before the end of the year. A lot can change, but our current forecast is that the bank rate is cut to 3% by the end of next year, so that's 2024, end of 2024, and 2.5% in 2025. Now, if this happens, I think arguably you see a scenario where interest rates have gone up like a rocket and they fall like a feather. We're not going to see interest rates fall as sharply as they have risen, and they have risen incredibly sharply indeed.
Do we ever want them to go back though to where they were? Is that a good thing?
No, arguably not. Right. I would say that we need them to stabilize around a more normal level. In the past, a normal level was about 5%, but I'm not sure that there's a nation of homeowners and businesses that really want it stabilizing around a normal level of 5%. And maybe the new normal is more like a 3%, 2.5 to 3% level, which, you know, even then would be substantially higher than they were. If we're heading back to like 0.5% or something, that's really bad news, because what would take us back to 0.5% is something really bad happening.
And I can't imagine what worse things could happen. Wars, pandemics, I don't even want to think. So, I mean, in terms of the pound in our pocket, as it were, borrowers, savers, how does all this affect us? Are we likely to see better savings rates, or have we peaked there as well?
Well, there's an interesting scenario there. Savings rates, in terms of easy access, have improved. We saw four banks yesterday raise their rates on decent quality accounts. There were others that also raised their rates. It's interesting how they're like quite quick off the mark, actually, some of them. But the four that we flagged, Ed Magnus, our savings guru, flagged, were Monzo, Atom, Chase, and Yorkshire Building Society. So we've got Yorkshire Building Society, its rainy day account, which is a easy access account that pays a higher rate on balances up to £5,000 and then a lower rate on balances above that, and limits the number of withdrawals you can make. But it's still a decent account, table topper. That has gone to 3.6% from 3.35%. You've then got Monzo. That has shifted up its instant access savings account from 3% to 3.2%. And that's a true easy access account. You can take your money out whenever you want. Atom has raised its instant saver, again, another true easy access, unlimited withdrawals, from 2.95% to 3.2%. And Chase has increased the rate on its linked savings account. You have to have a Chase current account to get one of these. That's gone up from 3% to 3.1%. So these are some decent moves. Easy access rates above 3%. The best ones is pretty much standard now. Fixed rates, slightly different story, because they rocketed in the wake of the, what should we call it this week? Calamitous mini budget. Kwasi Kwarteng's calamitous mini budget. In the expectation that the Bank of England base rate was going to go even higher than it has done. And it obviously hasn't. They ran quite a far ahead of the base rate. And so fixed rate savings, they've come down a bit, and they're probably not going to go that much higher. With fixed rate savings, you need to look more at what the expectation is for interest rates in the future. And same is true of mortgages. Again, mortgage rates rocketed after that mini budget. They have come down from their peak. They are still way, way, way higher than they were, but the best ones are knocking around just below 4%. The average rate is around 5% on a five-year fix, and a bit more than that, two-year fix, I think. So are they going to come down a bit more? Probably, yeah. You could see the scenario where interest rates continue to rise and mortgage rates come down a bit. And in fact, yesterday, the Bank of England announced that it was raising interest rates, and Nationwide Building Society announced that it was cutting mortgage rates. So there you go, prime example.
Any tips for us?
Move your money.
Yep.
Because if you've got money sitting on old accounts, then you need to get it into better accounts, because those old accounts are probably paying a rubbish rate. Don't just move your money with your own bank. Have a look at our independent Best Buy savings tables on This Is Money. thisismoney.co.uk/save, updated daily, all the best rates, and choose one of those for your cash. And then if you've got a mortgage, then you need to think about what's going to happen when it's time to remortgage and how much of that is going to cost you, and you need to start planning ahead. If it's up for renewal soon, i.e. in the next 6 to 12 months, have a look around, see if you can lock into a rate now, because they could go up further. And if they don't go up further, you don't have to commit to the rate. And before you take the money out, you could still move to a cheaper deal. Even if you don't have one that's up for renewal this year, check how much it's going to cost you in the future and start planning ahead, because people are staring down the barrel of hundreds of pounds a month more on their mortgage payments. And finally, get your savings into a cash ISA if you can. Cash ISA rates are better. The net gap has narrowed between them and standard accounts. And due to the rise in interest rates, you are more likely to fall into the savings tax net, because the personal allowance on savings is £1,000 and £500 for higher rate taxpayers. And higher rates mean it's easier to hit that level with the same amount of money in a savings account.
Lovely. Right, Simon, I did say I wanted to delve a little bit more deeply into the trouble in the banking sector. So two banks have needed effective bailouts in the space of just a few days. Those who remember the 2008 financial crisis could be feeling a little bit woozy reading this news recently. So should we be concerned? Is there anything that we should be doing right now? But firstly, Simon, I know we touched on a little bit earlier, but can we go into more detail in layman's terms, though? So in more detail, in layman's terms, just explain to us what on earth has been happening.
So remember, we keep saying that banks are much better capitalized and in a much better financial position than they were at the start of the financial crisis. And we don't need to worry about the banks. You know, banks are okay. People who've been listening to that over the years will now be scratching their heads and thinking, why have all these people told me the banks are absolutely fine and now there's some kind of banking crisis going on? Understandably, the question that keeps repeatedly being asked is this 2008 all over again? To which the answer is no, hopefully not. Brackets, hopefully not. But because banks are much better capitalized now than they were in 2008, that is true. But what's going on here is some quirks coming through, which are being triggered by that incredibly rapid rise in interest rates. And if you think about the fact that interest rates have gone from basically nothing to 4.25% in this country, higher in the US, in the space of a year, that is a really, really, really sharp rise in rates. and one that people didn't expect to happen. And you are obviously going to see some stress in the system if that happens. In fact, whilst people have spent the last however many years talking about these well-capitalized banks, there's also been quite a lot of people spending the last however many years saying there's going to be real problems in the bond market when interest rates start to rise. What has tried to keep a lid on that is central bankers and governments saying, ah, yes, but when rates start to rise, it will be slowly and gradually, so you don't need to worry. They then tore that script up, threw it straight out the window, and rates have gone up like a rocket into the sky. So the problem with bonds is if somebody holds government bonds, these are a very safe asset, because if it's a highly creditworthy government, especially one that can print its own money, it shouldn't go bust. They shouldn't default. They should always pay you back the money that you put in there. So you've got treasury bonds in the US, you've got gilts in the UK, you've got German bonds, for example, in the EU. These are all considered to be very, very high grade bonds. Large amounts of money have been going into these, and because interest rates have been so low, when countries were issuing the bonds, they could issue them at very, very low rates. So, for example, yields, which are basically, you know, we were talking 0.1% yields, 0.2% yields. And people, you buy the bond, say it's got a face value of £100. And if you hold that bond all the way to maturity, to its end date, hold a 5-year bond for 5 years, at the end of that 5 years, that government gives you your £100 back. And over those 5 years, you've been paid the coupon, which is also sometimes referred to as the yield of the bond, which is 0.1%. Now, if interest rates start to rise, governments have to start offering people higher coupons or yields on the bonds, on new bonds, in order to get them to buy them, because otherwise they could just put their money in a bank. So you get a scenario where you've got these old bonds that would pay you 0.1%, and you've got some of these new bonds that will pay you 4%. And if you're a bank, you hold your safe assets in these very safe government bonds. And if you hold them up until the end date, it's absolutely fine, because you'll get all the money back that you put in them. But if you need to sell them before the end date and interest rates have moved up substantially in the meantime, you've got a problem. Because when you go to the market and you say to someone, hey, got this $100 bond here, do you want to buy it off me? And the person who you're trying to sell it to says, yeah, sure. What's it yielding? And you say, 0.1%. And they look at you and they go, yeah, thing is, mate, I can buy a new one. Yields 4%. Don't think I want to buy that 0.1% one. Not for $100. I'll give you $50 for it. By the way, the maths on this doesn't work, so don't hold me to account on it. Just an example. So all of a sudden, your safe asset has got a problem, because if you need that money now, you can't sell it for what it's worth. You can only sell it for what it's worth to the buyer, not what it's worth to you as the seller, which is theoretically $100. This happened to Silicon Valley Bank. Needed to sell a load of bonds, lost a load of money on them. People freaked out slightly. All of a sudden, people started pulling their money out of the bank. I'm oversimplifying this just to be like very clear to anybody listening. The interesting thing about the Silicon Valley Bank run was that it wasn't a bank run of individuals, which is what bank runs normally tend to be, individuals rushing to take their money out. It was a bank run of companies. Silicon Valley Bank, unsurprisingly, has a lot of customers that were tech firms. And a lot of these tech firms are venture capital funded. And the way venture capital funded firms tend to work, early stage companies, is they don't really make much money. They don't often have much cash flow. What they do is they raise money, and then they burn through it, and then they raise some more money, and then they burn through it. And the idea is that at some point in the future, they're going to be highly, highly profitable. But at the moment, they're not. But they're disruptive tech firms, so you don't worry about it. They've had problems with raising some of that money recently, so they're quite nervous. It's much harder to do funding rounds than it was. They've got loads of people that they are paying an absolute ton of money, so their costs are quite high. And because they don't really have any cash flow, if they can't get their cash, they've got a real problem. Their business may cease to exist because they just cannot continue to keep it running. So when there was this concern about needing to get their money out of Silicon Valley Bank, there was a rush to pull the money out. And this exacerbated the scenario. This isn't what caused the whole scenario, but this is what exacerbated the scenario. And a hat tip to the FT, which wrote really interesting on this bank run on Silicon Valley Bank. And obviously it's quite easy nowadays. You don't have to go and queue up outside Northern Rock. You just like log onto your account, you move the money out. This is what led then to an emergency scenario where the Federal Reserve stepped in, the US government, and the US government stepped in and said, it's okay, we are going to guarantee all the deposits in Silicon Valley Bank, and also Signature Bank, another bank that was having similar problems. And we will create a new emergency lending facility called the Bank Term Funding Program. And this will allow banks to deposit high quality assets like those treasury bonds I was talking about, or US government backed mortgage bonds, in return for a cash advance worth the face value of the asset, not its market value. So don't worry about the fact that someone will only buy this off you for X when at its face value is Y. We will lend you money based on Y. And so this was, again, the confidence trick where the Fed and the government said, don't worry, it's all fine. Your money's safe. Calm down. And theoretically, that stops a bank run. Because when the UK government announced that it was going to stand fully behind Northern Rock deposits, all of a sudden, Northern Rock went from being the most risky bank to have your money in to the safe bank to have your money in. Because you didn't need to worry about the financial services compensation scheme limit at the time. Well, the UK government's backing it all. It's as safe as NS&I. And that's what they tried to do with these banks. Credit Suisse, on the other hand, is a slightly different scenario. Credit Suisse, bit of a basket case, as we talked about earlier. Due to the stress in the system, it was, you know, things peaked and it was forced into this emergency takeover by UBS.
We've also been reading about Deutsche Bank as well, another, dare I say it, slightly basket case of a bank. And it raised a question in my head, Simon, when you were talking about it earlier. If the banking system is so much safer, why are we telling people to Google Credit Suisse for a catalogue of absolute catastrophic misjudgments, errors, whatever? How was it allowed to carry on like that?
Well, it's paid a lot of money in fines.
Oh, well, great. So, marvellous. So, I mean, some of them are like spying and all sorts of just bizarre.
You do look at some of these things, yeah, and you do wonder. I wonder how much of this is still to do with the obscene levels of earnings within the banking system. And I'm not talking about people working in your local bank. I'm talking about the high-up people in banks, and then also in the investment banking and, you know, other more esoteric banking worlds.
I mean, saying with SVB that actually some of the bonus incentives were related to risk.
Yeah, look, and there's been a bit of rowing back on some of the rules that were brought in as smaller banks have angled for, you know, not to have quite the same level of regulatory pressure on them as bigger banks and things like that. I mean, you know, one of the problems with the SVB thing is it's to do with huge amounts of money sloshing around. These companies are sitting on ridiculous amounts of money. Why do they need ridiculous amounts of money? Because they spend ridiculous amounts of money. What are they spending ridiculous amounts of money on? Well, some of it is ridiculous wages for the people that they employ, who've then put their money into, you know, San Francisco local area banks, and they've got huge amounts of savings in the banks because they're being paid so much money by the company that employs them. And this is when we talk about cheap money. We've talked about cheap money for years. Is what does cheap money mean? Cheap money means that you can go and borrow some money from a bank at a very, very low rate of interest, and that makes the money cheap. And if money is cheap, people are less careful with what they do with it. And money is substantially more expensive now. If you take the basic example of someone who wants to borrow a mortgage in this country, 3 years ago, the cost of borrowing that mortgage fixed for 5 years would be 1.5%. Now the cost of borrowing that money for 5 years is 4%. So that money is nowhere near as cheap. So you can't get as much of it. And so you're more careful with it. And ultimately, at the end of the day, trace all the stuff back around, you know, the world of investment, of companies and things like that. The money's come from somewhere. And a lot of the money has been created through people borrowing it at very, very low rates of interest. And now everybody's being a lot more careful with their money, and it's creating stresses in the system.
So in sum, Simon, should we little folk like me, should we be concerned about our money, our jobs, our livelihoods?
I think what it should remind people about is that they shouldn't have more than £85,000 in any individually licensed UK bank or building society, because that is the financial services compensation scheme limit. And ideally, you want to make sure that you're below that. Those are the rules. Now, chances are something really bad happens, the government will bend the rules. That's what we've seen in the US, where they've got a, you know, they've got their own deposit insurance scheme, but they might not bend the rules. So be careful. It's your money. Spread it around. If you're with the NSNI, then, the, you know, theoretically, it's unlimited backing because it's backed by the UK government. Do you need to worry about your investments? Obviously, it's sent the stock market into a bit of a tailspin. But probably when you look back on this in years to come, it will be a blip, tiny blip that you'll struggle to identify in an upward line. It is, as we talked about, the rate rises are causing problems for people with their mortgages, but it's better news for savers. It's arguably been one of the triggers of such high inflation, is all that cheap money. But we're going back towards a world that's more normal, but it's not an easy path back to the world that's more normal. And anybody who thought we were just going to stroll straight out of 0.1% interest rates into a world of 4% interest rates and there wasn't going to be any problems was deluded.
To be clear, I don't think this is going to be a financial crisis. Famous last words. No. And I understand that everyone's being very cautious about it. And the reason being, as you've mentioned earlier, their sentiment can play an enormous role. All it takes is for people to start believing their money's not safe, taking it out, and then you've started to run. Is there anything that we can do to dampen the impact of sentiment on the system?
Trying to explain to people why it's not a problem, I think, is a good answer. That's what Andrew Bailey was trying to do that yesterday in his press conference. Trying to get that message across to people, but also not trying to cover things up and being open and honest with people and saying, well, look, yep, this is the thing. I mean, one of the problems this week was to do with how this Swiss bailout was structured, and people with convertible bonds, COCOs, 81s, whatever you want to call them, faced a loss when they shouldn't have faced a loss if equity holders weren't wiped out. And one of the criticisms has been that there's stuff going on that, rather than the joined up thinking that was mapped out post financial crisis, where everybody got together and worked out a way to sort out the banking system, when push comes to shove, you get individual countries just acting in the national interest. So that's been flagged as one potential issue. But I mean, good luck trying to get individual countries not to act in the national interest when they see a crisis emerging.
Indeed. All right, that's it for part one.
I'm joined now by Ben Laidler of eToro to give us an update on what's been happening on the markets. Ben, how's the past week been? Slightly shaky, safe to say, isn't it?
A little bit of a wild week. So it hasn't been a great one for the FTSE, and for a couple of good reasons. We had a bit of a shocking UK inflation report. Over 10% inflation went up rather than coming down. So we now officially, I think, have the highest inflation of any country we would like to be compared to. And we also had, I think, our 11th Bank of England rate hike to 4.25%, hopefully the last. But again, moving in the wrong direction if you've got a mortgage or a consumer loan.
What do we have to look forward to next week?
Hopefully it cools down a little bit. We're obviously all watching the banking scare that we saw mutate or cross the Atlantic from the US to Switzerland, and the UK sort of been a spectator on that so far. So hopefully that remains the case. It's also going to be the end of the first quarter, which has been pretty volatile and really saw the losers of 2022 rebound quite strongly to become sort of some of the winners of 2023 from sort of tech to crypto. So I guess we'll be looking to see if that continues.
Ben, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
Welcome back. So should you sell your investments now? It's a bold question, Simon. for this week's piece? Is it related to the previous thing we've been talking about or something else? Tell us more, Simon, about this week's thought piece.
No, it's got nothing to do with what we were talking about. It's got to do with some really simple stuff that we do know for certain rather than the uncertainties of the world. What we know is that come April the 6th, there's going to be a tax raid on profits and dividends from Jeremy Hunt. He announced this in the autumn statement. The capital gains tax allowance is going to be slashed from £12,300 to £6,000. And the dividend allowance is going to fall from £2,000 to £1,000. And then there's even worse news a year later when the capital gains tax allowance falls to £3,000 and the dividend tax-free allowance falls to £500. What this means is that above those levels, in any year, you will end up paying tax. And this will eat into the profits of investments that you sell, and it will eat into the income from the dividends that you receive. And it's bad news because what it does is it reduces your gains. But it has a compounding effect over the years where instead of getting nice, big, juicy gains compounding, you get gains minus that tax money compounding. And so you'll end up with less. But there is an answer to this problem if you have built up investments outside of an ISA, and that is to sell them, but to buy them back as well. You can do a thing called a bed and ISA, this quirkily named thing, which you're allowed to do. The tax man allows this. What you're not allowed to do is just sell something and then buy the exact same thing back straight away outside of an ISA. The advantage of that would be that you do something called crystallize your gains, i.e. make a profit, and then you can use this year's higher capital gains tax allowance against that. But the taxman's wise to that, and you have to wait 30 days before you buy the same thing back. So if you don't want it anymore, it's not a problem. But if you do still want it, then you can't just buy the same thing back. But what you can do is sell it and then buy it straight back within an ISA. Most investment platforms will do this for you. And if they can't, then you have to do the legwork yourself. The difficulty is if you hold stuff in a general investment account with one platform and you have your ISA with another one, then the money that you put in from that sale when you buy those assets back again will count as new ISA money. So it uses up some of this year's ISA allowance. But that makes this doubly profitable because, let's face it, most people cannot use their full 20,000 ISA allowance. So if you do this now, you can use up some of that ISA allowance. You cash in your capital gains. You get to use this year's higher allowance. And in future, your money is nicely tucked away in an ISA, protected from capital gains tax in the future and dividend tax in the future. And it can just sit there compounding away. And you can thank yourself that you did this before the end of the 2022-2023 tax year. And if you leave this for too long until after the 5th of April, you will not be able to take advantage of that higher capital gains tax allowance anymore. You can still do a bed and ISA, but you can't use that capital gains tax allowance and it'll use up some of next year's ISA allowance. And the last thing to say on this is if you're going to do this, you need to start thinking about doing it now. Don't leave it until the 5th of April. This is one of those things that takes time to do, particularly if you're doing it with one provider and then putting it in with another. So start thinking about doing it now. And then after you've thought about doing it now, actually do it. Don't do that thing where you just think about it and then don't do it until the 5th of April. Because if you leave it until 8 p.m. on the 5th of April, you can't do it.
All right, get your skates on. All right, finally, forget your Da Vinci's, your Patek Philippe's and your 1962 Ferrari Berlinettas. Pokemon cards are where it's at, apparently. Auctioneers are reporting a surge of interest in leading classic items like Pokemon cards, Casio watches and Lego to sell for tens of thousands of pounds. Barnaby said a wave of younger buyers and sellers is driving a 200% increase in the sale of these nostalgic items since 2019. They don't feel very retro or nostalgic to me, but anyway, Simon, tell us more.
So, Pokemon cards, investable asset? You might think not, but some people do think they are. And they've been around for quite a long time now, actually, and they have a track record of having some value and the rare ones rising in value. Barnaby's got in touch with us, said, look, we think we've got an interesting story for you here. And it's about these collectible items. So you've got your Pokemon cards, You've then got, and there's a long history of trading cards being valuable. There was a story this week. Did you see the story about the Panini sticker that was sold for all that money? Oh, I'm going to look it up while I'm talking to you, Georgie.
Okay. I like Panini stickers.
Yeah. Okay. So how much do you think a unique sticker featuring Lionel Messi issued for the 2022 World Cup sold for?
So there's only one ever been made.
I really hope that there is only one because the article says it's unique.
Just double checking because it
or
could
the,
be...
or, the, or there might be a misunderstanding of what unique
I mean,
means, but yeah.
You know, you never know, right? Okay, I reckon 250,000.
So it's the holy grail of Panini stickers, apparently.
Right.
Because Panini issued a limited number of stickers for all 600 players with different coloured borders to go alongside the standard white borders.
Right.
And the card was produced by Panini as one of a variation on the base Messi sticker. Obviously, the one for Messi became much more valuable because it's Messi and, you know, winning
it's
the World Cup and
them.
All that and so on. £115,000.
God, I was way over.
Yeah, you were way over, actually. lucky you didn't get involved in buying this. You'd be sitting on a Silicon Valley bank sized loss.
Wow.
So anyway, there you go. And that's a sticker that was only released a few months back, isn't it? So, you know, but then another item, retro cameras, Polaroid cameras. There's been a revival in the whole cameras that print your photos kind of thing. So the Polaroid is obviously the holy grail of these cameras, but you've also got these Fuji Instamax cameras that are really popular, haven't you? Vintage watches. But as you said at the top, we're not talking Rolexes and Patek Philippe's here. Casios, your Casio calculator watch.
Oh,
but the thing is rarity. It's rarity and originality. Because if you've got...
tossed them away because they were like...
Yeah, exactly. If you've got an original one of these and it's rare, and also old Lego sets and toys. So I guess old Lego sets unopened in their original packaging is peak there, not something you made out of Lego and then it got a bit broken and you've lost half the bits. Probably not worth that much money. Anyway, interesting article, interesting story. So we thought, right, we're going to cover this. But there's a kicker.
Okay.
Because I know a Pokemon card investor. So I mentioned this to Sam Barker, our assistant personal finance editor, who was writing the story. And I put Sam in touch with Adam Leslie, the Pokemon investor that we know. And Adam brought in some of his Pokemon card investments and gave us a real good talk through the market for them. And, you know, he is doing this, seeing it as an alternative asset class. And some of those stickers are worth a lot of money. So he's got a graded holographic first edition Charizard valued at £500.
Right.
These are graded. You get them. People officially grade them from 1 to 10. 10 is the best. And his is a grade 10 and it's worth 500. Rarer ones of these could be worth thousands of pounds. Also sealed packs of cards. So you buy the pack of cards. It's not opened. It's sealed.
Ooh.
Now you might think the value here is in opening the pack.
Right.
Because you don't know what you're going to get. You might get one of these really rare cards, but it's not. Actually, a lot of the value is that they are sealed and that they are not opened. And if you open them and you discover all the cards in there are just like ones that everybody's got, they're rubbish, then the value of the pack is destroyed. Now, if you've got a pack of cards that you just bought in a shop or on the internet this week and you don't open it, that's worth roughly the cost of a pack of cards. But if you've got one from some years back, right, then they start to get rarer because it's very easy to find a pack that you could buy now that's not opened. But it's much harder to find a pack from 10 years ago that's not been opened, or 15 years ago, or boxes, whole big boxes of them. There's some of those boxes, you could buy them for £150. They're now worth £300. Now, obviously, this is a market that is entirely based on sentiment, and sentiment can change. And the prices of these things rise and fall. And there's a lot of sentiment around these kind of collectibles at the moment, which has driven up the prices. And if people you know, go, oh, well, actually, no, I'm not so interested in that kind of stuff anymore. The price will fall. But the question is there a level at which the price will fall to that is almost a floor where people will then come and buy back in? That, you know, if, yes, the value of, say, for example, you take that Charizard card, is valued at £500 now, the value of that might fall when sentiment changes. But once it gets to 250, there'll always be someone who comes in and buys it. Who knows?
I mean, that's the question with any investment, isn't it? At which point do I sell up? Do you buy it because you love it? Do you, is Charizard, you say?
Yeah, this is a very popular character.
Okay.
Yeah. Well, right. It's the question with any investment that doesn't have any real intrinsic value, exactly. Isn't it? So if you buy a company share, then the company makes profits and pays you dividends. And so you can decide what you think that share is worth. But even then, it's subjective. Someone might say, well, it's worth five times the profits, and someone might say it's worth 10 times the profits. But if you buy something that doesn't do that, then it is entirely based on sentiment. Cryptocurrency, Bitcoin, gold, it really is entirely based on sentiment. But there's quite a lot of thousands of years of sentiment built up with gold.
Not so much with Pokemon cards.
No. When we, you know, look, when we were talking about this in the crypto boom, come back to me in 2000 years and tell me what your Bitcoin's worth, and then I'll tell you whether it's new gold.
But what's interesting,
come back to me in 2000 years, tell me what your Pokemon card's worth, and then I'll tell you whether it's the new gold.
Well, exactly. I guess a big point of this article was it's being driven by millennials and Gen Zs getting involved and buying this. I mean, it sort of reminds me of the crypto rush, as it were, during the pandemic, and people getting all concerned that the young'uns are being irresponsible with their investing and all that sort of jazz. Is it just a different way to invest now, or is it alongside other more sensible vehicles?
Well, I think what you have to remember is that many of the people who are investing in this stuff at the top end, who are buying large amounts, of serious collectors, serious investors, do unbelievable amounts of research. Adam was explaining to us about a way of, with these unopened packs, that you can work out whether it's worth opening them or not. So they have holographic cards in them, and if you get one with a holographic card in, it's worth much more, they're much rarer. And so people weigh the packs on a really sensitive set of scales, and they can work out whether, because obviously the holographic card weighs a bit more, they can work out whether it's likely to be in there. There's very high levels of kind of research going on in this, similar to, we talked about trainer investing a while back, didn't we? People investing in trainers and stuff like that. So I don't think it's an entirely reckless endeavor. Probably at the lower end, where people have just read this article and go, I'm gonna buy some Pokemon cards, and don't really do any research, then there isn't much thought going into it. But yeah, there is an element where this is similar to what happens in the classic car market, where you start to see the poster cars of certain generations accelerate in value when that generation reaches a point where it's got more money and can start to go out and buy the things that they always wanted as a youngster.
Yes, indeed. Before I let you go, Simon, just a very quick one. Bitcoin rising, crypto back?
Crypto back, yeah. I mean, who would have thunk that Bitcoin would manage to do something under the radar? We wouldn't have thought that not so long ago. But yeah, Bitcoin's had a bit of an under the radar rise this year. Mm. And when I say a bit of an under the radar rise, it's up 69% since the start of the year. It's still way, way, way below its peak, but it's trading at $28,000. There's been talked about Bitcoin wasn't the long-term store of value that people thought it was. It turned out to be a investment based on what's happening with tech shares and interest rates, and almost quite closely mirrors the performance of the Nasdaq, many would argue. But yeah, I guess, I don't know, is it the expectation that interest rate rises are going to stop, that they peaked? Is it people deciding that the banking system isn't as safe as they thought and Bitcoin is safer? I'd be quite wary of doing that with anything that has a recent history of doubling and halving in value and within very short spaces of time. But yeah, I don't know, it's on the rise again. It's an interesting one with Bitcoin, because with Bitcoin there's the thing of, like, has it been around for long enough now that there is a level that once it falls to that level, people will always buy in? And there was a suspicion, there was an argument in amongst many in the crypto world, that that level was $20,000 for one Bitcoin. And Bitcoin went straight down through that last year. And actually, it ended up that that level was more around the kind of $15,000 mark. Maybe, you know, maybe that's the floor. But I mean, there's every chance that it's not. So don't base any decisions on me pontificating.
All right, then. That's it for your pontifications this week, Simon. You can keep up to date with all the latest breaking money news. Just go to thisismoney.co.uk or download the app. And if you have any comments or questions to the team or anything you'd like them to look into, Simon.
You can email us at editor@thisismoney.co.uk. You can tweet us at thisismoney, and you come to thisismoney.co.uk/podcast to find all podcast paths and join in the debates in reader comments.
And if you like our podcast, why not rate us wherever you found us? It helps other people find us too.
Don't forget, you can stay on top of what's going on in the markets by tuning in to the Digest and Invest podcast by eToro. Go to your regular podcast platform and listen on the go. Digest and Invest by eToro, the podcast for those interested in trading and investing.